The entire problem in this article, aside from the cherry picking, is the lack of definition. If people don't know what you're talking about, and they are reluctant to embrace new ideas, they are going to let whatever preconceptions or misconceptions they have of this philosophy ooze into where information actually needs to be.
The philosophy of liberty is based on the principle of self-ownership. You own your life. To deny this is to imply that another person has a higher claim on your life than you do. No other person or group of persons owns your life. Nor do you own the lives of others. You exist in time, future, present, and past. This is manifest in life, liberty, and the product of your life and liberty. To lose your life is to lose your future. To lose your liberty is to lose your present. And to lose the product of your life and liberty is to lose that portion of your past that produced it. A product of your life and your liberty is your property. Property is the fruit of your labor, the product of your time, energy, and talents. Property is that part of nature which you turn to valuable use. Property is the property of others that is given to you by voluntary exchange and mutual consent. Two people who exchange property voluntarily are both better off, or they wouldn't do it. Only they may rightfully make that decision for themselves. At times, some people use force or fraud to take from others without voluntary consent. The initiation of force or fraud. To take life is murder. To take liberty is slavery. And to take property is theft. It is the same whether these actions are done by one person acting alone, by the many acting against the few, or even by officials with fine hats. You have the right to protect your own life, liberty, and justly acquired property from the forceful aggression of others. And you may ask others to help defend you. But you do not have the right to initiate force against the life, liberty, and property of others. Thus, you have no right to designate some person to initiate force against others on your behalf. You have the right to seek leaders for yourself. But you have no right to impose rulers onto others. No matter how officials are selected, they are only human beings, and they have no rights or claims that are higher than those of any other human beings. Regardless of the imaginative labels for their behavior, or the numbers of people encouraging them, officials have no right to murder, to enslave, or to steal. You cannot give them any rights that you do not have yourself. Since you own your life, you are responsible for your life. You do not rent your life from others who demand your obedience. Nor are you a slave to others who demand your sacrifice. You choose your own goals based on your own values. Success and failure are both the necessary incentives to learn and to grow. Your action on behalf of others or their action on behalf of you is virtuous only when it is derived from voluntary mutual consent. For virtue can exist only where there is free choice. This is the basis of a truly free society. It is not only the most practical and humanitarian foundation for human action, it is also the most ethical. Problems in the world that arise from the initiation of force by government have a solution. The solution is for the people of the earth to stop asking government officials to initiate force on their behalf. Evil does not arise only from evil people, but also from good people who tolerate the initiation of force as a means to their own ends. In this manner, good people have empowered evil people throughout history. Having confidence in a free society is to focus on the process of discovery in the marketplace of values, rather than to focus on some imposed vision or goal. Using governmental force to impose a vision on others is intellectual sloth, and typically results in unintended, perverse consequences. Achieving a free society requires courage to think, to talk, and to act, especially when it is easier to do nothing.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is September 5th, and on the show, we are going to be dealing with an article from Salon.com called Confessions of a Recovering Libertarian, How I Escaped a World of Ron Paul Hero Worship by Dustin Petzold. Now, if you're unfamiliar, Salon, a very liberal website, has this kind of ongoing series where they take somebody who supposedly was once a libertarian, but then saw the light, and now they sit at the adults table of politics with all the other responsible and forward-looking progressives. Now, a listener sent me this article, said you might find this interesting. A while back, I think like around episode 259, we did a show called From Libertarianism to Liberalism. How does that happen? And it was a pretty close to real-time reaction to another one of these Salon articles. So the person who sent me this enjoyed that show, said maybe I should give it another go. This time is a little different. Here's what I've done, just to make sure I'm not wasting my time or yours. I read the first paragraph, and I've read the last paragraph. And everything in the middle I have not seen yet. So we're going to try and do a real-time reaction. And even if we don't get really, really specific into the fallacies that are used in this article, I want to talk about the persuasive writing style, which is really junk, but unfortunately by many Salon readers, ingested as healthy mental food, to borrow some Mark Passio language. So again, the title of the article, Confessions of a Recovering Libertarian. Wait, we've got some stuff to do. First of all, a little bit of housekeeping here. Do you guys mind housekeeping? In the last show, I mistakenly thanked a man named David Chen for sending us some natty pop filters. David Chen was the seller. The real name of the donator was Steve Mooninite. So, of course, I want to apologize for giving an incorrect name. The real name And really, I'm so embarrassed here, I'm almost compelled to apologize to the entire 8-bit Mooninite family. Google Aqua Teen Hunger Force if you don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. Anyway, so this is September 3rd, 2014, Confessions of a Recovering Libertarian, How I Escaped a World of Ron Paul Hero Worship. And there's a line here, in the right hands, libertarianism could be a middle-of-the-road philosophy. Instead, here's what turned me away. When I was 15, I was that kid people wanted to punch in the face. All right, so from here on out, we're going to be operating in a poisoned well. I sent emails to Wolf Blitzer and Glenn Beck asking them just how in the world they could have said the Libertarian Party was fringe. I booed when my classmate mentioned the New Deal in a presentation on the Great Gatsby. When my Ron Paul 2008 sweatshirt went missing on a family vacation, I immediately implicated the CIA in the abduction. So the stage is set. I was a very silly, young, uninformed libertarian. I'm not that kid anymore, lucky you, which bodes well for the continued integrity of my facial structure. My views haven't changed as much as you might expect. I maintain that centralized government power, whether in the economic or social sphere, results in corruption and abuse more often than not. But when people ask me where I stand ideologically, I cringe at the thought of responding with freedom or limited government phrases that I once seemed so destined to have tattooed on my forehead. Now I'm more likely to stammer for a few seconds before coming up with something like, hey, it's pretty sunny out there today, no? People always told me that my staunch libertarianism would erode when I went to college and saw the world through a wider lens. I didn't believe them. Ooh. Ooh, listen to this. I didn't believe them, just as I didn't believe their claims that Ron Paul would fall short of the presidency. But we know how that turned out. That's very clever, right? So he's making a comparison. Actually, hold on. I got to pause for a second because that's definitely a fallacy and I don't know the name of it and I just can't think of it off the top of my head. Sorry, folks. This ain't the Stefan Molyneux hour. Hold on. I'll be right back. Okay. After a quick Google of comparison fallacy, there are several types of comparison fallacies, fallacious comparison, fallacious quantification, fallacious binarization, but none of those are relevant here. I'll just tell you what my problem was with what I read there. So by saying that it was just like when Ron Paul lost the presidential election in 2008, it's lending an undeserved credence to this idea that his staunch libertarianism would erode when he went to college and saw the world through a wider lens, right? Saying my belief that that wouldn't happen and my belief that Ron Paul would become president in 2008, equally silly. But he kind of has the momentum to carry the first statement that we all know Ron Paul lost the election in 2008. So anyway, contrary to how the story often goes, there was no professor, classmate, or piece of reading that exhorted me toward neoconservatism or Marxism. Instead, it was consorting with my fellow libertarians that drove me away. Oh, okay. Well, surprise, surprise. I can certainly identify with what he's saying there. I don't think it would drive me into any kind of philosophy that would lead to me being a contributor for Salon.com. But I'm interested to see where he goes, because like I said, I can sympathize with that. My realization of the libertarian tragedy began, as most tragedies do, with social media. Oh, amen. Maybe I should stop. No, let's keep going. Let's see what happens. All right. I attended college in Washington, D.C., a place that may not appeal to libertarians as much as it does to mainstream partisans, but still has a fair number of freedom-minded folks who call it home. When I was accepted for study, I connected with my school's College Libertarians Facebook group. They were a tight-knit bunch, but they embraced my eagerness to join their ranks. Soon, my Facebook feed was filled up with all kinds of Ayn Rand quotes and Gadsden flags. Posts like the one claiming that public schools, the very institutions that employed many of my family members, were replete with agents of state orchestrated indoctrination, were enough to keep me from ever showing up to a College Libertarians meeting. And this is where you know, I'm sorry I'm cynical. This is where I start to get a little suspicious of the pasts of some of these Salon contributors, because that's not an argument, right? That you're jaded because people are being critical of the public education, public schooling system, because you have family members who are teachers. That doesn't show very clear, very complete thinking, right? Teachers are not the ones orchestrating the indoctrination. It's an obedient profession. So if you're setting the stage for distancing yourself from libertarianism here, it's like as valid as like somebody criticizing what's pretty universally acceptable to criticize? Theft. And saying, whoa, these thieves. And you say, or somebody says, hey, my brother's a thief. It's not an argument against stealing. So let's see what happens next. Still, a few crazy Facebookers weren't going to douse my political aspirations. Good. I agree with you there. Political aspirations. Suddenly there's the appearance of political aspirations. Interesting. What are they? And that also points us to the fact that we're, what, we're in the fifth paragraph now, and he hasn't defined the thing that he's criticizing or the thing that he's fleeing, which is libertarianism. So I'm wondering what that means to him. Is it kind of like a Tea Party Republican thing? He's mentioned Gadsden flags. He's mentioned Ayn Rand. You know, all of that can be tied to republicanism through the Tea Party and Paul Ryan. So a definition would have been helpful here at the beginning, but there wasn't one. I made my way through a revolving door of internships on Capitol Hill and at nonprofits. It was in a congressional office that I became acutely aware of a group of people I called disciples and learned just how troublesome they could be. I want to be clear that a mere Ron Paul supporter is often completely different from a disciple. Plenty of people are sympathetic to the anti-establishment former congressman, and with good reason, but few of them reach the disciples' level of kookery. The disciples could not go a day without bringing their faxes and phone calls to the intern's attention. Their messages of, hey, vote for this bill because Ron Paul supports it, or all of the presidential candidates not named Ron Paul are guilty of treason. Posts like this were relentless. Yeah, I agree. That's a problem. We did a show years ago called Ron Paul, The Final Fantasy, and it sounds like he's talking about the same people we were talking about in that show. But at least even like a kind of zealous support of Ron Paul is not putting this faith in the state. So I would want to know what the alternative is here, but that hasn't been identified yet. I will be patient. Sometimes on rare days when internship-related drudgery hadn't caused me to glaze over, I would debate the disciples. Parenthetically, it says, this was explicitly not to be part of my job description. Oops. There was a consistent lack of constitutional literacy and current events knowledge emanating from their end of the phone line. One lady called me, particularly out of breath, over the fact that Obamacare would, quote, mandate microchip implantation for all citizens. When I asked her where she found this information, she referred me to a YouTube video called 666 Mark of the Beast. The disciples' approach toward gathering information seemed to be, if Ron or someone supporting him says something, take their word for it, which, interestingly, is the exact opposite of what Paul himself preached about activism on the campaign trail. So, well, I understand that an anecdote is helpful in this paragraph. It is obviously the fallacy of composition, right? If this is all that, or if this is the bulk of the criticism of Ron Paul supporters and libertarians, that somebody is worried about microchip implantation, so let's make a universal rule for libertarians or Ron Paul supporters, that's a little sloppy. Again, the composition fallacy. Bear with me one second. I have all this stuff in Evernote. Control, find, comp, and there it is. This fallacy is committed when an argument contains a premise in which a term is used collectively and a conclusion in which it is used distributively. The term is used collectively when it is used to refer to a class as a whole. A term is used distributively when it is used to refer to a member of each class. For example, all men die at some time. Therefore, there will come a time when no men are living. As far as we know, Each and every man will die at some time or another. But it does not follow that there will come a time when the species man will cease to exist. Composition has an opposite, which is division. This fallacy is committed when an argument contains a premise in which a term is used distributively and a conclusion in which it is used collectively. And we talked about composition and division in an earlier episode of our Logic Saves Live series called Reality Time for Bill Maher. So just the example, Bill Maher's primary target was Republicans. And he would do this thing where he would take a crazy congressman and talk about something that this crazy congressman did, something he said about rape or women. And he would say, what's wrong with these Republicans? So that's the composition fallacy. He would also do a division fallacy where he would, first of all, with a false premise, say all these big business owners are this, right? Mitt Romney is a big business owner, so Mitt Romney is this. Now, don't get me wrong, Mitt Romney sucks, right? But that still is a fallacy. And we can also label what Bill Maher does generally and what was done in this article as cherry picking or the fallacy of selective attention, right? So you're just having too small a sample size to make a general rule for a whole group. And I think on the Bill Maher show specifically, but this is also a big part of the progressive affect generally, and if we're going to be honest with ourselves, generally a part of the libertarian affect as well, people who disagree with me are idiots. So the way this would play out pretty much in almost every episode of the Bill Maher show would be, here's a guy who disagrees with me. Look what he did. Look what he said. Therefore, people who disagree with me, people who disagree with us, the adults of politics, are idiots. One would think that the craziest disciples would be limited to the type of people who had nothing better to do but call their representative on weekday afternoons. But a surprising number of these people showed up in nonprofit offices and at professional networking events. Young and naive as I was, the dogmatism of these libertarians surprised me. One of the reasons I was drawn to the liberty movement in the first place was its purported aversion to dogma. Libertarians rejected the two major party platforms that Americans are expected to conform to and instead took the initiative to seek out a more obscure way of thinking. There is a long tradition of skepticism among libertarian thinkers, so it's maddening to see this skepticism disappear when it comes to Ron Paul and his closest allies. Agree. The disciples engage in the same unquestioning hero worship that causes them to deride equally enthusiastic Barack Obama supporters as zombies or the particularly vomit-inducing sheeple. Agree. What a killer paragraph that was. I mean that with all sincerity. Okay. Maybe I'm digging a little bit too much here, but the only thing that really bothers me at all there is there's a word swap, and I don't want to call it a clever word swap because I don't even think this is on purpose. The use of the word dogmatism, right? It's very easy to swap out the word principles. The philosophy of liberty certainly has principles, and replace it with dogmatism, which is a malformistic way of describing unbreakable rules. So when the word dogma is used, and he's kind of setting the stage to talk about how dogmatic some of these libertarians are, well, that has a religious connotation that I think most readers of Salon would view negatively, even though progressivism is the most f***ing religious thing in the world as far as a faith-based rejection of reality is concerned. If the 20th century had any lessons for us, I'm sorry. I think that might just be the product of, you know, picking up some momentum while you're writing, and dogmatism is a word that captures a negative attitude towards libertarians. That's why I think it was used. I don't think it's an intentional swap for the description of principles. The high school me viewed libertarianism as a middle-of-the-road philosophy. Those what-are-your-political-views quizzes always placed me smack in the center of the left-right spectrum. My favorite libertarians always seemed to combine the best elements of conservatism and liberalism. I was concerned about the effects of their deficit spending and inflation, but I was equally interested in gay rights and the many costs of war. This particular blend of ideology went down smoothly with many of the people I talked to, so it seemed to me then that it would only be a matter of time before libertarianism would take hold with the non-Guy Fawkes mask-wearing crowd. Of course, libertarianism had not taken hold in any meaningful way because it is not a middle-of-the-road philosophy at all. In the right hands, it could be, but its current practitioners are keeping it on the margins of political discourse. Explain. Please explain. The two best descriptors that come to mind are extreme and rigid. Now, those are both malphemisms, which are the opposite of euphemisms, so let's see how well he fleshes this out. Libertarians could build up quite a bit of goodwill with their fiscally conservative and social liberal leanings, socially liberal leanings, if they didn't insist on leaning so damn far. Bullheaded, reductive platitudes like, okay, great, here's an example, taxation is theft, instantly alienate people who, say, are victims of actual theft. Oh, so we see a slight, I agree and disagree, right? Obviously, taxation is a legally legitimated form of theft. It's also an alienating statement for people who believe in something like a social contract. So I do agree that it's dangerous to throw those acerbic slogans at people like taxation is theft or soldiers are murderers, because you want a shorthand for, you know, throwing your angst at somebody else. But yeah, those statements do alienate people who've never thought about these things. And of course, most importantly, we're going to talk about this a lot in the upcoming Logic Saves Live show with Tony Myers. These people are lacking context. They've never read anything substantive about the libertarian philosophy. So that just comes off as kind of a shocking statement. And while these shorthand jarring statements might technically be true, they totally disregard the emotional volatility for somebody who's never heard of Lysander Spooner, right? So for a long time, and I was just like this, for a long time, I would run and hide behind this, hey, you know, I'm just telling people the truth. If they can't handle it, that's their problem. No, that's no good. So we've done lots of shows. We've done whole series, voluntary communication, go to schoolsucksproject.com, Google voluntary communication, on how to approach some of these difficult subjects with a much needed softer touch. Continuing. Knee-jerk anti-government sentiment is not a viable political philosophy. And this has been a criticism leveled at me by specifically liberals in the past. Oh, conservatives too. You're just against everything. And that's a problem of presentation. Right? That was a problem with how I was choosing to present the ideas of libertarianism in this world where government already exists. It's cruising along quite nicely. Everyone is participating through voting or getting taxed. And if you're not there to engage in a positive affirmation of that system, and you can be critical of it as long as you're presenting, you know, pre-approved solutions, but if you're not coming along to engage in that positive affirmation of the existing political structure or the acceptable political ideology, then you are just seen as being against everything. That is a real problem when people lack context. Continuing, it doesn't work in theory, and it's a disaster in practice. That's generally true, but it's what libertarians have allowed their movement to become. Their traditions of questioning authority and thinking rationally don't apply when it comes to their own authority figures and policy prescriptions. Cost-benefit analysis can provide a much more nuanced argument than all government is evil, but it's all too rare to see a libertarian making use of statistical diagnostics. So, okay, here's the problem. I think through the stories that he's provided, yeah, I was this confused teenager who was very attracted to this rebellious philosophy, and then I went to college and I was surrounded by all these nuts, and I interfaced with the philosophy of liberty on Facebook, right? So that's not really demonstrating a deeper knowledge of the philosophy. When he says that it's all too rare to see a libertarian making use of statistical diagnostics, he's omitting the work of so many people that, you know, Walter Block, Hans Hermann Hoppe, Stefan Molyneux, Bob Murphy, Tom Woods, Hayek, Hazlitt. There's a lot left out of that statement, right? And he's, again, it's the same thing. It's the composition fallacy. He's making a rule for libertarians universally based on a relatively selective experience. My recovery, another well-poisoning word, accelerated earlier this year when I received an internship with the help of an organization whose name would send most of this site's readers into anaphylactic shock. I'm guessing the Koch brothers, but that's just a guess. I was already grappling with serious reservations about continuing my career in politics, but as a freshly graduated English major with a liberty-heavy resume, I couldn't afford to turn away from those who somehow found it wise to pay me money for my services. Here I was surrounded by the type of people who wore suits to work daily, thrilled to one-up the business casual dress code. My coworkers awoke in the morning thinking about liberty, went to their offices and worked on liberty, took lunch breaks to talk about liberty, and then left work and volunteered at soup kitchens in the evenings. I'm just kidding about that last one. They went home and made Facebook posts about liberty, of course. They were the most paranoid, humorless, and obsessive people I'd ever been around. The perfect example of the kinds of people hijacking what could be a reasonable philosophical movement. They would return to work on Mondays talking about the Super Freedom Voluntarist America conference that they had attended over the weekend. I don't think that's a real thing. I probably would have heard of it. When I told them that I'd attended a Nationals game with some liberal friends instead, their faces looked as if I had made them eat live snails with smallpox sauce. It wasn't terribly surprising behavior from people who felt the whole world was against them and didn't own a book without the phrase anarcho-capitalist in it. Of course, while wading through the sea of interns, I met a handful of exceptionally kind, open-minded, and compassionate people, the type of people who reminded me why I used to be so proud to call myself a libertarian. These people were more willing to listen to arguments and read books by those they disagreed with. They were far more concerned by the effects of drug laws on minority populations than they were by a couple extra percentage points worth of corporate taxes for big businesses. Most importantly, they were eager to take breaks from politics outside of work hours, knowing that if they spent a few hours watching movies or playing in bands, America wouldn't turn into North Korea overnight. The problem is that their movement has been largely co-opted by zealots and politicians who are doing it harm. I hope that the rest of libertarians learn that this brand of unrelenting, self-serious extremism isn't helping their cause. The end. Well, that certainly was different from the last Salon article that I read on the show, and I apologize that it wasn't a continuous parade of me bullying the author by pointing out fallacies paragraph after paragraph. I think he actually made a lot of good points. Certainly, there were some questionable tactics used in that article, and I do want to say that just like the last article that we read from Salon, the author gets a lot done without clearly explaining libertarianism or the philosophy of liberty. We all are aware of this problem that the term libertarian is very bastardized to people like Rand Paul, who is currently advocating military intervention in the Middle East against ISIS, gets stuck with that label. Glenn Beck, who's doing a much better job. That Glenn Beck is doing a much better job. Bill Maher, for Christ's sake, gets labeled or has self-labeled as a libertarian. It's a word that really doesn't mean anything. So keeping it intentionally vague can allow Salon readers to fill their minds with whatever picture they want. Ted Cruz, right? And that certainly makes the presentation somewhat misleading. Now, as far as the good points made in this article, here's the thing. And of course, it's a shame that for most Salon readers, this is the only experience they'll ever have with libertarianism. Of course, it's something that they really want to dismiss, because if they examine the philosophy of liberty with any depth, there is a real risk of their current ideology being turned upside down. So people come to Salon and look for these articles to dismiss the ideas of liberty. So the theme for this show, I think, is really cherry picking. The author is talking about a very selective experience to arenas where the presentations of the philosophy of liberty really don't make it look that good. First one being politics, and the second one being social media, specifically Facebook. Now, let's talk about politics first. Even though we've talked about this on the show plenty in the past, politics is a place where people go to be angry, where people go to be paranoid, where people go to fantasize about bad things happening to people they don't like. It is a terrible place, an extremely hostile place for introducing new ideas. So I've never been convinced of the political strategy. There's a lot of people engaging in that in New Hampshire, And I've got a good friend right now who's actually running for office. He's actually been on the show in the past. I might have him on soon to discuss this. But that's politics. The second one, Facebook. You know, I remember, I think it was like Columbus Day. I posted something about Columbus Day years ago. And I wound up in this back and forth with this guy whose name was Brett. And I felt pretty gross after we went back and forth about 10 times and other people started getting involved. And I was like, this is not the best way for me to spend my time. This doesn't look like freedom for me to get locked into a conversation with some hardcore objectivist about the, I forget why Columbus was actually a hero because he civilized this hemisphere with modern banking and statecraft. It was pretty gross. But anyway, I took it into a private message and talked to this guy. And it was funny how quickly the tone, the language changed once it wasn't available to the public anymore, and how it actually became like solution oriented instead of just completely vitriolic. So getting locked into these endless back and forths with people on Facebook to me doesn't look like freedom. If you do this and you think there's merit, please write to me and explain why. I wouldn't even mind doing another show about that. We did a show about the Facebook conversation after the whole Sandy Hook thing when I was pretty irritated about that. So the author, Dustin, has this limited exposure to the philosophy of liberty. The readers of Salon are left with an even more limited exposure to the philosophy of liberty and libertarianism. So, solutions. I really am trying to move away from the word libertarianism. Progressives are also doing a pretty good job in the last couple of years of demonizing words like freedom and liberty. These are becoming like dirty words of irresponsible people. So I really like the idea of moving back to voluntarism and, you know, weeding out people like you. If somebody doesn't say, well, what does that even mean? They're probably not worth having a conversation. Face-to-face interaction is very effective. You can get away with a lot online when you're not face-to-face with people. And talking about what it is specifically. The entire problem in this article, aside from the cherry-picking, is the lack of definition. If people don't know what you're talking about and they are reluctant to embrace new ideas, they are going to let whatever preconceptions or misconceptions they have of this philosophy ooze into where information actually needs to be. And that's very important. So let's use better terms and let's define those terms. That is an absolutely essential part of reasoning with other people. Thanks for listening, everybody. More stuff is coming soon. The next Logic Saves live show is right around the corner. I need a few more days to make that the production it needs to be. I hope this will tide you over. It is my understanding that there are also other podcasts out there. I think you can search iTunes if you're looking for other shows. Don't, just kidding. Don't do that. All right. Bye.
Bad boy, Johnny.